This is the fifth and last lecture in the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner, the Bhagavad Gita and the Epistles of Paul. It is entitled The Spirituality of Maya, Krishna, the Luminosity of the Christ, Paul's Experience and Teaching of the Risen Christ, January 1st, 1913. In these lectures, we have considered two significant human documents, characterizing them only briefly, as was possible in our limited time, and we have seen what impulses had to flow into evolution in order that these two documents, the Bhagavad Gita and the Epistles of Paul, could come into being. It is still important for our understanding of them to show a fundamental difference between the whole spirit underlying these documents. We have already mentioned the teachings that Krishna was able to impart to his pupil Arjuna, teachings that could only be given to one person because of their intimate nature. Now, however, they are available to anyone because they come to light in the Gita. Of course, this was not the case at the time the poem was composed. Then these teachings did not reach all ears, as they were only communicated by word of mouth. In those ancient times, teachers were careful to ascertain a pupil's ripeness to receive such teachings. In our time, that is no longer possible for any kind of instruction, once it has come before the pupil in one way or another. We live in an age when spiritual life, to a certain degree, is open to all, which is not to say there is no longer any occult science, only that it does not cease to be occult science when it is printed or spread abroad. Indeed, there is plenty of occult science now. For example, Fichte's scientific teachings, available to anyone in print, are genuine occult teachings. Hegel's philosophy also is assuredly an occult teaching, as it is very little known and contains many expedients for keeping it secret. That is the case with many things in our time. These writings of Fichte and Hegel have very simple means for keeping them secret, as they are so written that most people don't understand them and fall asleep after reading the first few pages. This is true of much else now, which many people think they know but really do not, so the things remain secret. In fact, such things as are contained in the Gita remain secret even though they have become known in the widest circles through print. In its mighty revelations, one person perceives the evolution of his own nature, another sees in it only an interesting poem, and this reduces all its concepts and feelings to so much triviality. Let no one believe he has absorbed what lies in the words of the Gita, when he has merely understood their literal meaning, which may be far from their real meaning. In this way, the profundity of the poem in many respects protects it from being vulgarized. In any case, it is certain that such teachings, expressed poetically, are for each person to work through for himself. He must experience them if he is to lift his soul to the point of finally experiencing a meeting with Krishna, the Lord of Yoga. So, what the great teacher addresses to each person is a matter of individual concern. But it is otherwise with the epistles of Paul, when we view them from this standpoint. Everything there is directed to the community, to the many. But when we see into the innermost core of the Krishna teaching, we find that it is to be expressed in the deep privacy of the individual soul. One can only achieve the meeting with Krishna as a solitary pilgrim if he is to find his way back to the primal revelations and experiences of mankind. That which Krishna can give must be given for each one singly. This was not the case with the revelation given to the world through the Christ impulse, which from the outset was to be thought of as directed to all humanity. The mystery of Golgotha was not accomplished as a deed for single souls. When we consider all humanity, from the beginning to the end of earth evolution, what took place on Golgotha occurred for all men. To the greatest possible extent, it is a deed for the community of mankind. Therefore, the style of these epistles, apart from what I have already pointed out, must be different from that of the sublime Gita. Bring vividly to mind once more the relationship of Krishna to Arjuna. As Lord of Yoga, he gave him specific directions for lifting up his soul step by step, so as to attain a vision of Krishna. Compare this now with a particularly pregnant section in the epistles, where a group of followers goes to Paul and asks if this or that thing were true, whether they were in accord with what he had been teaching. And in Paul's instructions is a passage which in its greatness is equal throughout, even artistically, with what is in the sublime Gita. But it is in a quite different tone, a quite different way of expressing a soul experience. It is where Paul writes to the Corinthians about the variety in human talents present in a group, and how they must be brought to work together. Krishna said to Arjuna, quote, "You must be so and so, do this or that, then step by step your soul will progress." Unquote. Paul said, quote, "One of you has this gift, another that, a third another. If these work together harmoniously, like the members of a human body, a spiritual wholeness results, which then can be permeated by the Christ." Unquote. Thus, through their common situation, he could direct them to the idea of men working together, that is, as a plurality. He made use of a special opportunity to do this, namely when the gift of speaking with tongues came up for consideration. Now, what is this speaking with tongues we find in the Pauline epistles? It is none other than a survival of ancient spiritual faculties, which, in a renewed but fully conscious way, confront us again at the present time. In our methods of initiation, inspiration is a condition one may attain with the same clear consciousness one has in the everyday use of his reasoning and sense perception, but it was otherwise in olden times. Then the person concerned spoke as if he were an instrument of higher spiritual beings, who made use of his organs of speech to express higher truths. Thus, one could say things he himself could not at all understand. Communications were made from the spiritual world that the transmitter did not need directly to understand. Right in Corinth, such things were occurring. A condition had arisen there in which a number of people had this gift of speaking with tongues. Now, with a person having this gift, what he brings forth is under all circumstances a revelation from the spiritual world. Nevertheless, it can be that one person says this, another that, because there are many regions in the spiritual world. These differences in inspiration bring it about that the revelations do not always agree. Only when one enters the different regions in full consciousness does he discover how they harmonize. Therefore Paul admonishes his followers, quote, "There are some who have this gift of speaking with tongues, and there are others who can interpret the message. They should work together like the left hand with the right. We should not merely listen to the one spoken through, but also to those who may not have this gift, but know how to interpret what one or the other spiritual region imparts." End quote. In this way, Paul again urges them on to achievements as a community founded on their united efforts. Connected with this speaking with tongues, Paul gave that discourse, which, as I said, is so wonderful that in certain respects it can be compared in still another way with the communications in the Gita. He said in 1 Corinthians 12:3-31, footnote, the quotations from Paul's epistle to the Corinthians have been translated from the German edition, since what Rudolf Steiner offers is somewhat different from the usual English translations. As he has pointed out, for example, in his knowledge of the higher worlds and its attainment, the source of his spiritual research lies beyond the scope of the documents of external history. End footnote. Quote, "Concerning the spiritually gifted brethren, I will not leave you without directions. You know that in the period of your paganism a blind desire led you astray to dumb idols. Wherefore I give you to understand that as little as one speaking in the Spirit of God says, quote, 'Accursed be Jesus,' unquote, so little can he call him Lord, except it be through the Holy Spirit. Now through grace there is a diversity of gifts, but only one Spirit. There is a diversity of men's achievements, but only one Lord. Individual men have a diversity of strength, but only one God is active in all these forces. To every man is granted manifestations of the Spirit, to each one's prophet. Thus, to one is given words of prophecy, to another knowledge. Again, there are those who live by faith, others who have the gift of healing, others have the gift of prophecy, others have insight into the character of men, to others the gift of tongues, and others can interpret the speaking with tongues. But in every man works the one Spirit, apportioning to each his due. For as the body is one, with many members, all the single members forming together one body, so is it also with the Christ. For through the Spirit we are all baptized as one body, whether Jew or Greek, slave or free man. We are all filled with one Spirit, as the body consists not of one, but of many members. If the foot were to say, "Because I am not the hand, I do not belong to the body," nevertheless it does belong to the body. If the ear were to say, "Because I am not the eye, I do not belong to the body," it would even so belong to it. If the whole body were only eye, where then is the hearing? If the whole body were only hearing, where then is smelling? But God has given each member a particular place in the body, as he found it good. If there were only one member, there would be the body. If there were only one member, where would be the body? So there are many members, and only one body. The eye dare not say to the hand, "I do not need you," neither the head to the feet, "I have no need of you." Rather, the apparently weak members of the body are necessary, and those members we hold in low esteem prove to be especially important. God has put the body together and given to the undistinguished members their significance, in order that there will be no schism in the body, but that all members work together in harmony and have care for each other. When one member suffers, all suffer with it, and when one prospers, all rejoice. But you now are the body of Christ. All of you together form his members. Some among you he has appointed to be apostles, others to be prophets, a third portion to be teachers, a fourth to be miracle healers, a fifth to have other helping tasks, a sixth to be administrators of the community, and a seventh he is appointed to speak with tongues. Should all be apostles, or prophets, or teachers, or healers, or all speak with tongues? Should all be interpreters? Therefore it is right that the various gifts of grace work together. The more they do so, the better. End quote. Then Paul speaks of the force that may be active in each one, but also in the community, the force that brings together all the single members of the community, as the strength of the body unites the separate members of the body. Nothing more beautiful did Krishna say to one man than Paul said to humanity with its variety of members. Then he speaks about the power of Christ that unites diverse individuals, as the body unites its various members, the force which thereby can live in each one like the life force in each member, yet also lives in the whole entity of a community. This Paul characterized with powerful words. Long quote again. "Indeed, I will show you the way higher than all the other ways. Though I could speak out of the Spirit with tongues of men or of angels and have not love, my speech would sound as brass and a clanging cymbal. And though I could prophesy and reveal all mysteries and communicate all the world's knowledge, though I have such faith as would remove mountains and have not love, it all would come to nothing. Though I gave to others all my spiritual gifts, yes, though I gave my very body to be burned and have not love, everything would be in vain. Love endures. Love is kind. Love does not know envy, nor boasting, nor vanity. It does not violate property. It does not violate propriety, nor seek its own advantage. It does not let itself be provoked to anger. It bears no malice toward anyone, nor rejoices over injustice, but only over truth. Love encompasses everything, permeates all beliefs, is hopeful in all things, and in all matters practices tolerance. Love, if it be love, is never lost. A prophecy ceases after it is fulfilled. What is spoken with tongues dies away when it no longer speaks to human hearts. Knowledge vanishes as soon as its subject is exhausted, because all knowledge is fragmentary, likewise all prophesying. But when that which is complete has come, then the fragments have lost their meaning. When I was a child, I spoke as a child, I felt as a child, I thought as a child. Since I have become a man, my world of childhood is past. Now we see only dark outlines in the mirror, but one day we shall see the Spirit face to face. Now is my knowledge in fragments, but one day I shall know fully what I myself am. Lasting is faith, lasting the certainty of hope, and lasting is love. But love is the greatest of these, therefore it is supreme. All spiritual gifts may be yours. He who is able to prophesy must also strive to attain love. He who speaks with tongues speaks not among men, but among gods. No one hears him just because he utters spiritual mysteries." Unquote. We see that Paul understands the nature of speaking with tongues. He means, quote, "The speaker is carried away into spiritual worlds and talks among gods. He who prophesies speaks with men to edify them, exhort them, or give them consolation. The one speaking with tongues in a certain sense gives himself satisfaction in doing so, while the prophet edifies the community. Even if all of you are able to speak with tongues, it is much more important that you prophesy. The prophet is greater than the speaker with tongues, unless the tongue speaker is himself able to understand what he speaks in order that the community understand it. Suppose I come to you as a speaker with tongues, of what use am I to you if I cannot tell you the significance of what I say as prophecy, as teaching, as revelation? My speaking would be like the tones of a flute, a zither, which you could not clearly distinguish from one from the other. How is one to distinguish the playing of a flute or zither if they did not produce different sounds? If the trumpet did not give out a distinctive sound, who would arm himself for battle? So it is with you. If you cannot put your tongue speaking into a distinct language, your speaking goes into thin air. Unquote. All this shows that the various spiritual gifts must be distributed among the members of the community, and that the members as individuals must work together. With this, we come to that moment in human evolution when the revelation of Paul occurred, and we see how it must differ fundamentally from that of Krishna. The Krishna revelation is directed to the one individual, but actually to every person who is ripe to progress on the soul's path upward, as outlined by the Lord of Yoga. Ever again are we directed back to the primeval time of humanity, to which, according to the teaching of Krishna, we want to return in spirit. At that time, man was less individualized, so one could assume that the same teaching and guidance was suitable for everyone. Paul confronted humanity when individuals were becoming differentiated, when they had to become differentiated, each with his own special capacities and gifts. No longer could one count on pouring the same thing into every single soul. One had to point to what ruled invisibly over all, that which is in no one man separately, but can be in every single one, is the Christ impulse. His force is again similar to a new group soul for humanity, but such a one as is consciously sought by humanity. To make it clearer, let us imagine a number of Krishna pupils in the spiritual world, and a like number of those who have been deeply impressed by the Christ impulse. Each of the Krishna pupils have been set alight by the same impulse given them by the Lord of Yoga. In spiritual life, each is like the other. To one as to another, the same instructions were given, but those stirred by the Christ impulse are disembodied in the spiritual world, each with his own particular individuality, his own differentiated spiritual forces. So that also in the spiritual world, one person can function in one way, another in another way. The leader of both, the one who pours himself into each one, however individualized that one may be, this is the Christ. He lives in every soul, and at the same time hovers over them all. Thus there is a differentiated community, even when souls are disembodied, while the Krishna pupils are a unity if they have received direction from the Lord of Yoga. The meaning of evolution, however, is that souls become more and more differentiated. Therefore it was necessary that Krishna speak in another way. Basically, he speaks as he did in the Gita to his pupil. But Paul has to speak otherwise. Actually, he speaks to every man. Then it is a matter of individual development, whether each one, according to the degree of his maturity, stops with exoteric life only at this or that stage of his incarnation, or whether he embarks on esoteric development to raise himself to an esoteric Christianity. One can proceed further and further in Christianity to the most esoteric heights, but one begins on a different basis from that given in the Krishna teaching. There one starts from the standpoint of what he is as a human being, and raises his soul however he can achieve it as a single person. In Christianity, before he can even begin to advance, he enters upon a relationship to the Christ impulse, so that this transcends all else. The spiritual path to Krishna can only be followed by one who receives his instructions. Anyone can follow the path to Christ, because he brought the mystery for all people. All can find a relationship to it. That, however, was something consummated on the physical plane. The first step, therefore, is taken on the physical plane. That is the main point. Once a person grasps the world-historic significance of the Christ impulse, One truly needs nothing from this or that Christian doctrine in order to proceed. Particularly in our time, one can even take his start from an anti-Christian point of view or a feeling of indifference. When one looks deeply into what our time is able to bring to spiritual life, when one sees the contradictions and foolishness of materialism, then perhaps one is led most genuinely to the Christ these days, more so than if he came to him through some special creed. Therefore, when it is said outside our circle that we set out from a special kind of Christian belief, it can be regarded as an especially vicious slander. For it is not a matter of starting out from some kind of denominational doctrine, but from the demands of spiritual life itself. Everyone, be he a Muslim, Buddhist, Jew, Hindu, or Christian, can understand the Christ impulse in its full meaning for humanity's evolution. This is exactly what we see penetrating Paul's entire concept and presentation. He is the personality who sets the tone for the first proclamation of the Christ impulse in the world. Having described how the Sankhya philosophy was concerned with the changing of forms, with what pertains to prakriti, we may now say that Paul, in all that underlies his most meaningful epistles, deals wholly with purusha, with what is of the soul, what the soul is destined to become, the manifold ways in which it is to develop throughout man's evolution. All this Paul sets forth in quite definite, conclusive ways. There is a fundamental difference between what Oriental thinking was still able to produce and what comes from Paul in such a wonderful clarity. Yesterday we pointed out that with Krishna, everything depended on man finding the way out of the changing forms. But prakriti remains outside as something foreign to the soul. All striving within this Eastern method of development, even within Eastern initiation, is toward becoming free from material existence, from the outer world of nature, which according to the Veda philosophy is Maya, illusion. Everything outside us is Maya, and yoga is the way to become free of it. We have noted how, directly in the Gita, it is required that man free himself from everything he does, achieves, wills, and thinks, from what he desires and enjoys, and that in his soul he triumphs over everything external to him. The work he does falls away from him, so resting in itself it finds satisfaction in itself. Thus anyone who desires to develop himself according to the Krishna teaching has in mind becoming something like a Paramahamsa, a high initiate, who leaves behind all material existence and rises above all his deeds in the sense world, who lives in such a pure spiritual state as to lose all thirst for incarnating again, because he no longer has any connection with what lives in this sense world as his work. Thus we are confronted everywhere in the Gita with escape from this Maya, this illusion, with the triumph over it. But it is not like this with Paul. If he had encountered this Eastern teaching, the following words would have risen from the depths of his soul. Quote, "So you want to develop yourself away from everything that surrounds you, away from whatever you have accomplished in the outer world. Do you want to leave all that behind? Is it not the work of God? Is not all that above which you wish to lift yourself the creation of the Divine Spirit? When you disdain that, do you not cast scorn upon God's work? Do not the revelations of God and His Spirit live everywhere in it? Did you not seek above all to reveal God in your own work with love and faith and devotion? And now you desire to triumph over God's work?" Unquote. It would be good to inscribe deep in our own souls these words of Paul, which, if not actually spoken, ruled in the depths of his soul, for in them comes to light a vital nerve of what we know as Occidental revelation. Even in a Pauline sense, we speak of the illusion that surrounds us. Indeed, we say, quote, "All about us is Maya," unquote. But we also ask, quote, "Is this Maya then not divine revelation, not the work of divine spirit? Is it not blasphemy not to understand that in everything the divine spiritual is at work?" Unquote. Now the other question arises, why is there Maya? Why do we see illusion all around us? The Occident does not stop with asking if everything is illusion. It wants to know why. Here an answer leads directly into the realm of the soul, into purusha. because the soul once came under the power of Lucifer. It sees everything through the veil of Maya, and of itself spreads the veil of illusion over everything. Is objectivity at fault, that we see Maya? No, true objectivity would appear as a quality of soul if we were not under the power of Lucifer. It seems to be Maya, because we are not capable of seeing to the roots of what is spread about us. Lucifer's power prevents it. The fault does not lie with the gods, but with our own soul. You, as soul, have yourself changed the world into Maya by the fact that you have succumbed to Lucifer. From the highest spiritual expression of this truth, a direct line leads down to Goethe's words, quote, "It is not the senses that deceive, it is judgment," unquote. The Philistines and the Zealots may oppose Goethe and his Christianity all they like, yet he still was entitled to say that he is one of the most Christian of men, because to the roots of his nature he thought like a Christian, right into that saying, quote, "It is not the senses that deceive, it is judgment," unquote. The soul is at fault in that what it sees does not appear as truth, but as Maya. Thus what in Orientalism is simply an act of the gods is diverted into the depths of the human soul, where the great battle with Lucifer begins. So, when we truly observe Orientalism, we see that in a certain way it is materialism, just because it does not recognize the spirituality in Maya and wishes to rise above matter. Pulsing through the epistles of Paul, however, is a teaching for the soul, even though in germinal form and therefore easily misunderstood in our Tamas time. It is this that in future will leave its imprint everywhere throughout the whole world. This unique nature of Maya must be understood, for only then will it be thoroughly clear just what man's chief concern must be in the further progress of his evolution. Then one will understand what Paul meant in speaking of the first Adam, whose soul was victimized by Lucifer and thereby fell ever deeper into matter. This means nothing else than that it was ensnared in a false experiencing of matter. Matter in the external world, as God's creation, is good. What takes place in that realm is good. But that which the soul experienced in the course of human evolution became more and more evil, because in the beginning it was overpowered by Lucifer. Paul named Christ as the second Adam, because he entered the world untouched by Lucifer, and could therefore be that friend to men who could gradually lead them away from Lucifer, that is, into a right relation to Lucifer. Paul could not communicate to people in his time everything he knew as an initiate. But whoever absorbs the contents of the epistles will discover that more lies in their depths than comes to expression on the surface. That is because Paul had to speak to a certain community, and must therefore reckon with their ability to understand. So there is much in his epistles that seem to be contradictory. But if one penetrates their depths, one will indeed find everywhere in them the impulse coming from the being of Christ. Remember how we ourselves describe the entrance of the mystery of Golgotha into human life, how to make it possible, as we previously indicated, two differing children's histories were mentioned in the Matthew and Luke Gospels, because actually there were two Jesus children. We pointed out that according to their physical descent, quote, after the flesh, unquote, as Paul put it, the two Jesus boys stemmed from the house of David, the one from the Nathan, the other from the Solomon line, and that two Jesus boys were born at about the same time. In the one cited in the Matthew Gospel, Zarathustra was incarnated. The other described by Luke was not endowed with an ego such as specially characterizes a human being. And as the other Jesus boy had, who was so highly developed because it was the ego of Zarathustra that lived in him. In the Luke Jesus boy lived a part of man's being that had never before entered human evolution on earth. Footnote: see Rudolf Steiner, The Spiritual Guidance of Man and Humanity, The Gospel of St. Luke, and the Gospel of St. Matthew for a full exposition of the problem of the two Jesus children. End footnote. Here we come to a point where it is somewhat difficult to find the right concept. But try to imagine how the soul incarnated in Adam, in what could be designated as Adam, as meant in my occult science, how that soul succumbed to the temptation of Lucifer, symbolized in the Bible by the fall into sin in paradise. One can get a picture of this. Then, further, besides that human element that incarnated in Adam's body, another part remained behind, a human entity that did not enter a physical body, but remained purely soul. You need only to imagine that before physical man arose within human evolution, he was a soul, which then divided into two parts. The one part, a descendant of the common soul, incarnated in Adam, and thereby entered the ongoing stream of incarnation, succumbing to Lucifer, and so on. For the other part of the soul, the wise world rulership, foresaw that it would not be good if it also were incarnated. It was held back in the soul world, apart from the stream of incarnation. Only those initiated in the mysteries would have any connection with this sister soul. Also, this soul, during evolution that preceded the mystery of Golgotha, would not take ego experience into itself, since that comes only with incorporation into a physical body. Therefore, this soul possessed all the wisdom which could be experienced through the Saturn, Sun, and Moon periods of evolution. It possessed all the love a human soul can attain. It remained innocent of all the guilt that humanity can incur in the course of its incarnations for the purpose of development. This soul was then such a one as could not be encountered outwardly as a man, but could only be perceived by means of the old clairvoyance. In this way it could also be seen communing, one could say, in the mysteries. Thus there was a soul, both within and yet above human evolution, visible only to spiritual perception, a primeval man, a veritable superman. It was this soul which, instead of an ego, incarnated in the Jesus boy of the Luke Gospel. It was similar to an ego, acted quite naturally like an ego as it penetrated the body of Jesus, yet it was different from the usual human ego. I have already mentioned that this boy could at birth speak a language understandable by his mother, and other similar faculties were evident in him. The Jesus boy described by Matthew, in whom the Zarathustra ego lived, continued to grow up to his 12th year, likewise the boy of the Luke Gospel. But the latter showed no special knowledge nor erudition, no particular gift for learning the external things people usually learn. Rather, he bore within him divine wisdom and a supreme capacity for sacrifice. We know further that the body of the Matthew boy was forsaken by the Zarathustra ego, which, in his 12th year, took possession of the body of the Luke boy. That is the moment indicated as his appearance before the learned ones in the temple, teaching them while being lost from his parents. We also know that the Luke boy bore the Zarathustra ego within him up to his 30th year, that then this ego forsook the body of the Luke Jesus, and the sheaths that had surrounded it came into the possession of the Christ, a superhuman being from the hierarchies, who only under such circumstances could live in a human body. For him a body was provided that had been permeated up to its 12th year by primeval wisdom, by powers of divine love. Then it was streamed through by all that the Zarathustra ego had attained during many incarnations through initiation. Through nothing, perhaps, does one acquire the right esteem, the right reverence, above all the right feeling for the being of Christ, so much as when one tries to understand what kind of a bodily nature was necessary for this Christ ego to be able to enter into humanity at all. In this presentation of the being of Christ, given by the holy mysteries of the modern age, many have found him to be less intimate, less human, than the Christ some people have honored as he is usually presented, familiar, near to man, embodied in the ordinary kind of human organism in which nothing like a Zarathustra ego lived. Our teaching has been reproached for presenting Christ Jesus as combining forces from every region of the cosmos. Such reproach only arises from laziness in people's thinking and feeling, which will not lift them up to their true heights. Besides, the greatest is only to be grasped after exerting the soul to the utmost, so as to attain that inner intensity of feeling needed to raise the soul even to approach the level of the greatest, of the highest there is. One's first feeling then is only heightened when the matter is seen in this light. In addition, we know how these words of the Gospel are to be understood. Quote, divine powers are being revealed in the heights, and peace is spreading among men of good will. unquote, the tidings of peace and love resound as the Luke Jesus child is born, for the Buddha is intermingled with his astral body, that being who had already lived through his last incarnation as Gautama Buddha and had risen to total spirituality. So that in the astral body of the Luke Jesus boy, the Buddha was revealed, showing how he had progressed up to the time of the event of Golgotha on earth. So we have pictured the being of Christ Jesus as it could be given to humanity for the first time. Today, we may say, out of the foundations of spiritual science. Paul, even though he was an initiate, had to speak in the more easily understood concepts of his time. He could not have assumed that a humanity would be able to at that time to comprehend such concepts as we have been able to bring to your hearts today. That which came about through his inspiration was due to the initiation bestowed upon him by an act of grace. Because he had not attained it in the regular prescribed schooling of the ancient mysteries, but through the risen Christ having appeared to him on his way to Damascus, I say this initiation took place through grace. But Paul's experience of this vision was such as to convince him that what had arisen from the grave and the mystery of Golgotha lives on, bound up with the earth's sphere ever since that event. He recognized the resurrected Christ, and him he proclaimed from that time onward. How was it that Paul was able to see the Christ just as he did see him? Here we must enter a little into the nature of such a manifestation as that of Damascus, for it was quite a special kind. Only those people who do not want to learn about occult facts assume that everything visionary is the same. They do not distinguish between a vision, such as Paul's, and the many others that have appeared to the saints in later times. What actually was the reason Paul was able to perceive the Christ in the appearance of Damascus? What was there in it that convinced Paul it was the risen Christ? This question leads back to another one, namely, what was necessary in order that the total being of Christ could descend completely into Jesus of Nazareth, as indicated by the baptism by John in the Jordan? We have just said what was necessary to prepare the physical body in which the Christ was to dwell. But what was needed for the risen one to appear to Paul in such a dense soul form? What was that ray of light, so to say, in which he appeared? What was it? Whence was it taken? If we are to answer this question, we must add several things to what I have already said. I told you of the sister soul present along with the Adam soul, which had entered the sequence of human generations. This sister soul remained in the soul world. It was also the one incarnated in the Luke Jesus boy. But this was not the first time, in the strict sense of the word, that this soul was embodied as physical man. Previously, it had once been prophetically incarnated, and earlier still had been used as a messenger of the holy mysteries. It came and went among them, was cherished and cultivated, so to say, and sent out wherever something important was taking place among mankind. But it could only appear in the etheric body, and therefore, strictly speaking, could only be perceived as long as the old clairvoyance continued. That, however, did exist in earlier times, so this ancient sister soul of Adam did not need to come down as far as the physical body in order to be seen. Thus it actually appeared repeatedly within human evolution on earth, always sent forth by the mysteries when important things were to be done. But it did not need to incarnate in ancient times while clairvoyance lasted. This incarnating became necessary for the first time when clairvoyance faded away during the transition from the third to the fourth Atlantean epoch. Then it took on a kind of substitute embodiment in order to continue its functions after clairvoyance had ceased. This sister soul of Adam was embodied, so to say, in Krishna, the only time when it had become physically visible, and then again it was embodied in the Luke Jesus boy. So now we understand why Krishna spoke in such a superhuman way, why he is the best teacher for the human ego, why he appears as an overcoming of the human ego, why his soul qualities are so sublime. Because in that exalted moment we described several days ago, he appeared as man, not yet immersed in the stream of human incarnations. Then he appears again in order to be embodied in the Luke Jesus boy. Thereby the height of perfection was reached, when the most profound world concepts of Asia, in the ego of Zarathustra and the spirit of Krishna, united in the 12-year-old Jesus boy. The one speaking to the learned men in the temple was not only Zarathustra speaking as an ego, but also one having all the resources Krishna had once drawn upon in proclaiming yoga. He spoke about a yoga now raised a step higher. He united himself with the power of Krishna, with Krishna himself, in order to continue developing up to his 30th year. Only then was that physical organism so completely matured as to be ready for the Christ to take possession of it. Thus do the spiritual streams of humanity flow together. So when the mystery of Golgotha occurred, there was indeed a working together of the most important leaders of mankind, a summation, a synthesis of spiritual life. As Paul journeyed to Damascus, it was the Christ who appeared to him. The flood of light that enveloped him was Krishna. Because Christ took Krishna as his own soul sheath, through which he then continued to work, everything that once was the content of the sublime Gita streamed from him. So much in the revelations of the testaments, even if in scattered fragments, comes from the ancient teaching of Krishna. But that teaching became something for all humanity, because the Christ as such is not merely a human ego belonging to mankind, but belonging to the higher hierarchies. For this reason also Christ belongs to those times when man was not yet separated from what now surrounds him as material existence, and through his own luciferic temptation is enveloped in Maya. A look back through the whole of evolution shows that in ancient times there was not yet that sharp division between the spiritual and the material. The material was still spiritual, and the spiritual, if we may put it so, was still manifesting itself outwardly. Because in the Christ impulse something entered humanity that completely excluded such a sharp separation as existed in the Sankhya philosophy between Purusha and Prakriti. Christ became the leader in taking man out of himself, but also toward divine creation. Dare we say, then, that one must absolutely abandon Maya when we recognize that it appears to have been given us through a fault of our own? No, for that would be a blasphemy against the spirit in the world. It would mean assigning to matter qualities that we imposed upon it ourselves under the veil of Maya. Instead, we should much rather hope that when we conquer in ourselves that which caused matter to become Maya, we may again be reconciled with the world. Do we not hear sounding out from the world around us that it is a creation of the Elohim? That on the last day of creation the Elohim looked and found that all was good? It would be karma fulfilling itself if there were nothing but the teaching of Krishna, for nothing remains in the world that does not fulfill its karma. If in all eternity there had only been a Krishna teaching, the material world surrounding us, the manifestation of God, of which the Elohim said at the beginning of evolution, quote, "Behold, all is very good," unquote, would be met by man's judgment, quote, "It is not good, I must abandon it," unquote. Human judgment would be placed above divine judgment. This is what we must learn to understand in the words that stand there as a mystery at the beginning of evolution, that we do not set human judgment above divine judgment. If ever all the things that could cling to us as guilt could fall away and only the one offense remain, that we blasphemed the creative work of the Elohim, the earth's karma would have to be fulfilled. Everything in future would have to crash down upon us, and thus karma would have to take its course. That this should not happen, Christ came into the world. He came in order to bring us into true harmony with the world, that we might learn to overcome the power in Lucifer's temptations, to penetrate the veil of Maya, to see divine revelation in its true form, that we recognize Christ as the one who reconciles man and his world, and leads him into the reality of divine manifestation, so that through him those primeval words may be understood, quote, "Behold, it all is very good," unquote. In order that we learn to attribute to ourselves what we must never attribute to the world, for that we need the Christ. Could all other sins be lifted from us, this particular sin must be taken from us by Christ. Transformed into a moral feeling, this reveals a new aspect of the Christ impulse. At the same time, it shows why it became necessary for this impulse as a higher soul to envelop itself in the impulse of Krishna. My dear friends, such matters as I have brought before you in this series of lectures are not to be taken as mere theory, as a compilation of ideas and concepts to be absorbed. They should be received as a kind of New Year's gift, a gift to work influentially through the coming year. From these indications should flow a continuing experience of what one can understand of the Christ impulse and the way it throws light on the words of the Elohim, which sounded forth at the beginning of the creation of our world. This must be understood. Look, too, at what at the same time has been our intention to show as the point of origin of our anthroposophical spiritual stream. Through it, the way man can come by himself into self-knowledge will be made ever more widely known. Not yet can he achieve self-knowledge completely. Not yet can anthropos attain knowledge of anthropos, man gain knowledge of man, so long as he considers that what he has to bring about in his own soul is an affair to be played out between himself and external nature. It is a requirement prepared by the gods that we see our world immersed in Maya. It is a matter for our own souls, higher self-knowledge, that man be conscious of himself within his human situation. It is a concern of anthroposophy that through it we first experience what theosophy can be for mankind. It should be with the greatest modesty that one feels impelled to belong to the anthroposophical movement, a modesty that reminds one that if he wants to jump over the concerns of the soul and take at once the highest step into the divine, his humility can easily vanish, and pride and conceit take its place. May the Anthroposophical Society also be a starting point to this higher moral sphere. Above all, may it avoid the pride, vanity, ambition, and lack of earnestness which have so easily slipped into and been a burden to the theosophical movement in receiving the highest wisdom. May the Anthroposophical Society at the outset avoid such hindrances by observing what solving the problem of Maya entails as a concern of the human soul itself. One should feel that the Anthroposophical Society is the result of the deepest human modesty. Then out of this modesty will come the greatest earnestness in confronting the holy truths we shall reach when we enter the realm of the supersensible, the spiritual. Let us therefore regard the adoption of the name Anthroposophical Society with genuine humility, and say to ourselves, may whatever pride, conceit, ambition, dishonesty, which could have been working under the name of theosophy, be eradicated as we begin humbly to look up to the gods and divine wisdom. May we dutifully seek likewise to know man and human wisdom when we reverently approach theosophy and dutifully devote ourselves to anthroposophy. This anthroposophy will lead us to the gods, if through it we learn to see ourselves truly and devotedly, and see how we must struggle against all Maya and error by means of severe self-discipline and training, then, as if written on a bronze tablet, there will stand above us the word anthroposophy. May it be an admonition to us that above everything we should seek through anthroposophy self-knowledge, humbleness of self, and in this way endeavor to erect a structure founded upon truth. Because truth only blossoms when self-knowledge in full earnestness puts its roots deep down in the human soul. From what does all conceit, all untruthfulness arise? They result from failure in self-knowledge. From what alone can truth and genuine reverence for the divine worlds and divine wisdom spring? Only from real self-knowledge, self-discipline, and self-development. May the forces streaming and pulsating through the anthroposophical movement serve this purpose. For this reason has this particular cycle of lectures been given at the start of this anthroposophical movement. They should prove that we are not dealing with something narrow, but that just in our movement our horizon can extend over those distances that encompass Eastern thought as well. But let us grasp this humbly in the anthroposophical way of self-education. arousing our will to self-discipline and training. If, my dear friends, anthroposophy is taken up by you in this way, it will lead to beneficial results. It will attain a goal bringing to every person and to every branch of human society a measure of regeneration. These words then bring to a close this series of lectures, but perhaps from them you can take much with you for times to come, much that will be fruitful for our anthroposophical movement, for which you have come together in these days for the first time. May we always so meet together under the sign of anthroposophy, that we can always be justified in reaffirming the words with which we now conclude, words expressing a spirit of humility, of the desire for self-knowledge, as we now in this moment bring them before our souls as our ideal. The end of Lecture 5 and the end of the lecture cycle, the Bhagavad Gita and the Epistles of Paul, given by Rudolf Steiner in Cologne from December 28, 1912 to January 1, 1913.